You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 9th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. In pursuit of a smarter way to do leisure, visualising the arts from graphic to conceptual, meeting some feline fanatics down under, and getting behind the lens with a relaunched heavyweight that is a photographer's bible. Diverse, independent, and never far from the world's presses, this edition of The Stack is ready to go. This week, our Stack newsstand features a kaleidoscopic spread of some of the newest, best, and most unusual trends and titles in print. On Monocle's dedicated print media review show, we'll be joined in studio by some expert industry guests who will, as always, be helping us filter the global magazine offering with their top picks. We'll also be going to Melbourne, where some furry friends and those who own them are celebrated in print.
We found that there were, and some of the people that are featured in the magazine are just as cat crazy, if not more so. They have cats of their own, they have books, they have pictures on the wall, they're, you know, just literally obsessed.
And then back to London, where a much-respected photographic journal turns into a must-have annual edition.
And one of the things that is core for us at Photoworks is commissioning. And I felt that there was an opportunity here to change it into an annual publication, I say that softly, so somewhere that hovers between a magazine and a book or a journal.
All that and plenty more besides on this 63rd edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Tuck and I'll be taking you up the garden path of print, that is, for the next 50 minutes, on behalf of our normal host, Mr. Tyler Brulé. So, without further delay, let's see who's round the table this week. Whether it's boutique hotels or adventure sports, fine wines or airports that are destinations in their own right, Ted Moncrief is a man who knows the best of travel writing. Ted is editor of Bloomberg Pursuits magazine, the global lifestyle luxury publication from Bloomberg Markets magazine. Ted previously worked for Condé Nast Traveler for 15 years, including 4 years as executive editor. Following that, he was executive editor at Newsweek and then executive editor and content strategist at W magazine. Ted, welcome to The Stack. I know you've been here before with Mr. Brulé, but for listeners who don't exactly know all about the magazine, just explain to us what Bloomberg Pursuits is.
Bloomberg Pursuits is a luxury lifestyle title that goes to the Bloomberg Terminal customer, which is about 355,000 people living in 50-plus countries, all native English speakers, mostly the financial capitals.
And the content, it's delivered digitally or in print?
Both. We do a very glossy print publication that's quarterly, and then we also do a very robust iPad edition.
And tell me, the topics that you cover, are we being a bit kind of judgmental thinking it's going to be fast cars and things that for people with rather a lot of money?
We do fast cars, but we also do art, travel, philanthropy, human interest stories. Journalism is Bloomberg stock and trade, and we try to leverage that as much as possible.
And we listed all those places that you've worked, a great roster of places, Newsweek, being at Condé Nast Traveler. Is there a lineage through all of the things you've done? Are you still going back to some of the stories and places, today for Bloomberg that you might have been covering actually at Condé Nast Traveler?
Yes, although in a very different way. I mean, Traveler definitely has the travel aspect covered. Newsweek just plays to Bloomberg's heritage as a journalistic organization. NW, we do fashion and style a fair amount, and that was, of course, an invaluable experience.
Brilliant. Well, we're also joined by another magazine expert and friend of The Stack, Mark Valley, a Brazilian who came to Britain via Switzerland, where he studied economics in Lausanne. He's now the editor of the widely respected art magazine Elephant and owns Magma, a string of high-end bookstores throughout the UK, specialising in art, graphics and design periodicals. Is this the time of year over the kind of next 2 months where you kind of make all your money so you can go and sit on that beach in Brazil?
Yes, it is. I don't sit on the beach in Brazil, but it is when we make whatever little money we actually manage to make. Our turnover in the last 2 weeks before Christmas goes up I don't know, 10, 12 times from what a normal day would be. So it is the crazy period for us.
And you know, we're talking here about magazines, but I know you do sell books. And do you tend to see one or two books, you know, rising to the top of the pile as the, you know, the hits already? Do you know what are going to be the best sellers this Christmas?
We try to guess them, but you never know until the last, those last 2 weeks. The whole turnover is made really on the last 10 days before Christmas. That's where when it really counts. And you never know what people are suddenly going to put into their heads that this is the ideal Christmas present. And I must say, unfortunately, books are no longer top of the pile. In a way, gifts and other things have become top of the pile, and this is where a lot of our money is made from today.
And here at Monocle, we're always encouraging people as they kind of disappear for Christmas or the summer to still buy a stack of magazines to kind of pile up over Christmas to kind of sit around the log fire. Do you find that actually it's also a good time for magazine sales as well?
Beginning of December, the two first weeks are pretty good, actually. They're possibly the best time to sell magazines in our shops. However, in the last week, I must say, people just, you could just put the magazine shelves aside. People are just in a panic trying to, they're just feeling guilty, thinking, granny, what should I buy for granny or my cousin Joe or whatever, you know.
Well, as someone who only ever starts Christmas shopping actually after our Christmas lunch, which is about 3 days before Christmas, I might be one of those people coming into your store panicking again this year, I think. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the stack. And we'll be hearing more from both Mark and Ted in a moment. Hello, if you've just tuned in, I'm Andrew Tuck and you're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. We're staying unusually local now. We're going to Southwark right here in London. This week, Photoworks, the UK's foremost photography platform, relaunched its much-respected journal as Photoworks Annual. In line with the blurring of magazine and book publishing, this new edition is big. 500 pages of beautifully printed photos, essays and, yes, advertising. It feels book-like, and you'll certainly be hard-pressed keeping it anywhere beside your coffee table. Monocle's David Pleasant met Photoworks director and editor Celia Davies and the man behind the new design, creative director David Lane, and asked them to guide him through this new photographic colossus.
Photoworks previously was a magazine that was published twice a year, and it'd been going 10 years. And I've recently taken up the post as director at Photoworks, and we looked at what were the options moving forward in terms of the magazine market, which has changed hugely, actually, since that originally started. And one of the things that is core for us at Photoworks, one of our values, is commissioning. And I felt that there was an opportunity here to actually change it into an annual publication. I say that softly. So somewhere that hovers between a magazine and a book or a journal. But the important thing within it is that it's about really high quality content, really good writing, and that we would actually make something very collectible, because obviously now in the, you know, the age of the digital revolution, everyone is publishing online, and so how do we make ourselves distinctive? How does it feel different, and how does it have visibility?
You've gone for high quality content. You say the writing. You might expect Photoworks to focus on photographs, pictures. How have you made sure, you know, what's the editorial process behind what you've gone for? Because there is a lot of text, there's a lot of stories, and very little advertising.
Actually, there is advertising at the back, but we kept it subtler, and I think that doesn't undermine the advertisers or our clients. Actually, it's about it all being in one place, so that voice about what photography courses there are, what products there are around photography, is all in one section. We made a very deliberate move as well to only do full-page advertising, which I think is quite important in the visual appeal, but also to all the clients, there's a parity with what's happening there. And that actually, again, when you open it, you get straight into the editorial. But also there's different types of articles in there. There's folios of new work, there's essays, there's shorter articles in response to one image. So what I like about the prospect of this as a publication is that you can slowly read it. You know, you don't have to read it in one train journey. In fact, it's probably too heavy for a train journey, but it might be something you have at home, relaxing, or in your workplace, when you just want time out from the computer screen, and actually to read something that feels quite very tactile, very collectible, and very chunky.
If you look at the landscape of commissioning a photographer's photo work, it's a pretty dire picture for some people, would you say? Or do you think, are you seeing a lack of decent commissioning? You know, is it kind of too many photographers for too few commissions? Do you feel that's one symptom of that kind of digitization process that you've talked about before?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to be too straightforward about it, but I think there's a difference between showcasing work and doing an article on it. Commissioning is about a dialogue with an artist. It starts very, very early on. So you identify who you want to work with, you understand what their practice is about, and you help nurture that. And within this particular issue, we commissioned Jawhara Al Sood and also Claudia Sola. And there was a conversation with each of those artists about, in the same way you might do for an exhibition, for example, what is the opportunity of the printed page? What is the opportunity of that sequence, for example, within our theme? And I was fortunate enough, for example, to be having a holiday in New York and over the summer, so I met with Jawhara as well, and we talked through everything that she was thinking, and we Skyped. So it's not just send us your images. That's interesting. Let's have an essay on it. It's actually, so what's the opportunity here on the page, and how can that be tweaked, and what are we trying to say within the theme? So it's a discussion.
Is there a challenge with an annual to bring in new readers just for the visibility and the kind of impact that is obviously that bit more limited and that more rare during the year?
Yes, there are challenges to all publishing. I mean, I think the interesting thing here is that magazines have a shelf life and you might shelve them afterwards and not read them again. This hopefully does have an annuality to it. I think the readership is potentially even broader now, because I think we've broadened out who's writing for PhotoWorks, who we're commissioning. And we very deliberately said as a subheading, photography, art and visual culture, and that's what we're exploring. We're exploring photography as a subject, not just showing photographs. It's actually what is in the photographs themselves, that's the interesting thing. And that is so expansive and so exciting for us that I'm looking forward to seeing all the new people who might become members.
My name's David Lane. I was brought on board to redesign PhotoWorks magazine, which used to exist as a quarterly, and this year has become an annual. And in becoming an annual, they really wanted to rework everything.
And what is that design process of transforming something from a quarterly into an annual? It's quite a big step. What's the kind of design process apart from just making it bigger?
Well, because I hadn't been involved in the quarterly, it was very much the same design process as anything afresh. You know, it was approaching the brief as if it was a brand new magazine that was becoming an annual. Obviously, there were things about the old issue that they wanted to keep and things that they wanted to change, so they were part of the brief as much as anything else. But I think, yeah, the point of it being something to keep is really, really important. I think, like you say, publishing is going that way. I think with the kind of amount of content online, if you're going to really own something and invest in something, it should be something you keep. And we've made a real choice with the papers, the quality of the print, the format, the amount of pages. It's much more in line with a book, really. I mean, it's actually better quality art book papers than a lot of art books use. There's probably more words and more essays than a lot of books would have as well. So,
and for a photography title, that is one thing that stands out, the text, the essays. Was that kind of like an important part in terms of the design and kind of typography and layout and things like that? Were you very keen to show that side of things as well?
Definitely. It was a definite conscious choice from the organisation's point of view, looking at the other magazines that were available. And there are lots of fantastic photography magazines, most of which represent kind of contemporary portfolios of people and projects and commissions. And what PhotoWorks has as an organisation is amazing access to lots of writers and curators and critics. And it's something that they do and have done, but they've done across lots of medium. And I think they wanted to sort of bring it all back into the annual.
That was Monocle's David Pleasant speaking to PhotoWorks director and editor Celia Davies and creative director David Lane. You're listening to The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck, on Monocle 24.
The Monocle book tour has touched down in the warmer parts of the globe, and this November we'll be packing the snowshoes and chilling out in the Nordic region. Starting on November the 18th in Stockholm and taking in a different country each day, we'll be shooting through Oslo and Copenhagen before ending up in Helsinki on the 21st, and we'll be bringing you live shows right here on Monocle 24 from each stop along the way. So if you want to hear how the Monocle Guide to Better Living is going down in the snowier parts of Europe, point your mouse towards book.monocle.com and be sure to tune in to Nordic Leg of the Monocle Book Tour this November on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome back to The Stack. I'm Andrew Tuck. Here at Midori House in London today, I'm joined by the editor of Bloomberg Pursuits magazine, Ted Moncrief, and editor of Elephant and General Magazine aficionado, Mark Valley. And it's now time to delve into their stacks. We're going to start with you, Ted. I think you were rushing through Paris yesterday, trying to grab magazines apparently off the shelves as you kind of jumped on the train.
In the 3 seconds I had before I had to get on the Eurostar, that is correct.
Actually, railway stations, before we move on. Monocle was recently in Stuttgart, and I was amazed actually how many European rail stations are actually still great places to pick up magazines. We were in Stuttgart. I think it's one of the biggest magazine stores I've ever seen. Tens of thousands of titles. Paris, a good place to pick up?
Not pick up magazines,
by the way. It may be a good place to pick up. You can tell us about that after the show.
In this particular case, no. It was a fair amount of well-established titles, which is fine, but I'm always usually looking for something that I haven't encountered before.
Now, you've got a title there, which is from the Condé Nast stable. I'm not sure if you're trying to get yourself back in that stable. No.
you're
just being nice to your former employees. You have The World of Interiors, a British magazine, and a title which, oddly, has never been replicated, I don't believe, in any other market, has it?
Not that I'm aware of.
So, you know, unlike
which is a shame.
Yeah, unlike AD, which they kind of run around the world, The World of Interiors has remained a peculiarly kind of British title. What made you pick this one up?
Just what you say, which is that it's extremely idiosyncratic. It doesn't feel like it's selling me housewares at every turn. It feels more like a voyeuristic, idiosyncratic peek into some very peculiar and strangely inspiring houses.
Yeah, I think that they show you everything from like a hermit's cave to a palace. And the other thing, I think they were one of the first magazines really to shoot places that looked a bit rough and scruffy, oddly. They're quite happy if something's a bit dilapidated and been torn apart by age.
Yes, I think they prize the human touch, whereas I think a magazine like AD, for all of its virtues, I always get the sense that the decorator just left and that the inhabitants haven't junked it up with their stuff.
Are you a regular buyer of interiors magazines, though?
There's a couple that I favor. I mean, World of Interiors, unfortunately, and I don't know why, I don't subscribe to it. So whenever I'm here, it's often the first thing I grab. I get El Decor. I get a couple of the others. There are not as many as there used to be.
And I think the other good thing about the World of Interiors is that they were one of the first magazines where, if you're a subscriber, they send you an issue with no cover lines on. It's just completely stripped back to the photograph, which is a really beautiful thing to do when you see it in people's homes. You know they're a subscriber, and two, it just looks oddly elegant, that magazine, without any cover titles on.
But yes, I think they're celebrating that it's a print product, and they're making it even more of a coffee table book than, say, this one, which does have cover lines.
Mark, does World of Interiors get a place on the shelves at Magma?
Not really, no. I think it's possibly a bit traditional for us.
So you'd more move into the territory of something like Apartmento, would you, for interiors magazines?
Apartmento's very successful in our stores, yeah, definitely.
Now, what's the first title you've brought in for us today?
Well, it's a title that surprised me. I mean, when you invited me to the show, I went to the shelves and had a look at the endless lines of fashion magazines we have. And this one really, it completely puzzled me. At first, I couldn't understand what it was, and then I got it. That most fashion magazines are about everything except the clothes. You know, it's the looks, it's everything that goes around, it's the glamour. But this is actually about the clothes.
And you should tell me the title of it.
It's called Article, which again is a brilliant title, Article Clothing, an article in a magazine. And it has this fantastic spine with the exposed stitching, which totally matches the tailor's idea and all of that. And it's all about making clothes and the people behind clothes, people making clothes in traditional ways, It has fantastic fashion illustration. It has many different papers. So there's an equal attention paid to print as there is to the texture of textiles. And it's just beautiful.
Now, I've seen this title before, and the thing that I like about it is actually it's pretty well written as well. What's strange is so many of these fashion titles come out where it's based upon, you know, as you say, some crazy stylish shoot, and it's not really about the person who's going to end up wearing those clothes. And they have terrible, terrible writing in it, or they use writing as kind of putty around a picture, and they don't care whether you can read it or not. Article is very beautifully laid out, and it's very, very readable. That somebody does proper journalism, proper research, and that's, you know, I think that the mixing of the two in one title is really impressive.
That is true, and they talk magazine language in a brilliant manner. I mean, there's lots of little touches, like, for example, the editorial is on a flap on the cover. And so you don't get that boring first editorial page. I mean, this is a brilliant idea. There's a photo shoot here where the clothes are actually, it's about articles of clothing that have actually been forgotten in different places. So instead of having somebody wear glasses, you have somebody's left their glasses on a pile of clothes, or somebody's forgotten their woolly hat by a grave. And then it ends with somebody forgetting their wallet in a locker, you know, and you can actually not see the wallet. And I just thought, this is the funniest fashion photo shoot I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's great when some of these smaller titles, you know, they have the space in a way to do wit as well. Because, again, many of the more established fashion titles, they get a little bit po-faced sometimes around the world of style and fashion. Tell me, when fashion pops into Bloomberg Pursuits, what are you looking for out of shoots, and what are you trying to convey in stories?
We're looking to convey a context, an air of reality, a situation in which an actual human might actually wear this garment. We did an accessory story in our holiday issue, which was a natural time of year to do it. The idea was to stage it as a party in a Paris apartment. Very chic, slightly dirty. There's a fantastic picture of a woman who is wearing a Graff 139 carat diamond cuff, but she is washing her hands with bar soap in a pedestal sink filled with champagne and ice. It's just an outrageous shoot, and it's all credit to the stylist and the art director and the photographer, who really took what is a very magazine staple idea and really elevated it into something much, much more, I think, inspiring and engaging.
And so just on that kind of borderline between, is the photograph the thing in itself, or should the people who look at that photograph want to buy something or wear something or experience something? You're more on the side that actually this should be giving something to the reader, I guess.
Absolutely. And we did a shoot in Marseille where I was in a room with a representative of one of the luxury brands, and she admired it. And I said, what do you like about it? And she said that the clothes are the third thing that you notice.
Brilliant.
Which I thought was an inspiring comment as an editor.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much so far. You're not going anywhere, because we've got lots more work for you to do in this show. I'm Andrew Tuck, and this is The Stack. Niche magazine publishing is nothing new to us on The Stack, but one new title from Melbourne is arguably taking niche to a whole new level. Photographer Gavin Green and graphic designer Jessica Lowe have published a beautiful art magazine, not just about cats, but about creative people and their cats. Delicately designed with the air of a contemporary art or high fashion title, Cat People, which is written in both English and Japanese, is proof of the diversity, talent and breadth of independent publishing. In Melbourne, Loretta Florence caught up with Jessica and Gavin.
Cat People is a bilingual English-Japanese magazine. It's released annually. This is our first issue. It's really our dream magazine, combining all of our creative heroes. We thought it would be a lot smaller. It's now ended up being 146 pages. With interviews of four cat people.
We visited Japan last year. We went to the Tokyo Art Book Fair, and we kind of expected to find something similar at the fair and didn't. And so that really acted as a catalyst for us to be able to complete the project for the next book fair, which is what we did. We don't speak Japanese, either of us, but we love it. We love the place, we love the people, and they have a reverence for print that we also admire. Given that and the subject matter, which obviously the Japanese love cats, we thought, well, it makes sense to have it bilingual, and that way our Japanese readers can really get the full experience.
It's a magazine about cats, but I guess also about design and the people who have the cats and what their homes are like. How do you come up with an idea like this?
I think we were really inspired by Japanese books and magazines and how they focus on one particular subject. Obviously, we're big print and cat obsessives ourselves, so we were really looking on a project that we could work on together and combine our interests in art, fashion, photography and design.
I think we thought that maybe we were the most obsessive in some ways to make this magazine, but we found that there were, and some of the people that are featured in the magazine are just as cat crazy, if not more so, and so they have cats of their own, they have books, they have pictures on the wall, they're, you know, just literally obsessed.
At the beginning, there's a double page spread of each of our contributors, all the writers and artists, and we ask them questions about their cat and they've all provided photographs, and it's funny to learn about, oh, their cat does that as well, oh, our cat's not that crazy. It's quite funny.
We encouraged that there was a bit of cat chat, at least at the start, and that they could kind of compare notes on their cats. Of course, the conversations then kind of go into other aspects of the featured people's lives, such as their artistic practice. And so cats are used as a device to connect all these creative people and to feature them and profile them. And so for us, that was really interesting because we do love, I mean, I come from a kind of editorial background in my photography, so I have a deep interest in people and I kind of like exploring them and their houses and things. And so it was a way to do that and obviously photograph their cats and get to know their cats, get to know their work. So it seemed to really tick a lot of the boxes for both of us.
It's an interesting size because it's not an A4, but it's not A5. Can you tell me a bit about the size of the magazine and the paper that you've used for it?
The size of a magazine is a Japanese B5. So it's something that you could fit into your bag and carry around like a little book, but it's still big enough to feel like a magazine. We set out to use a variety of specialty paper stocks to act as a separation between each creative person section. We use cast-coated paper, silk and uncoated. It's a mix that really flows through the magazine and showcases the talent.
Do you have a particular favourite page from the magazine or favourite segment?
I guess what's been really exciting for us and probably the signature piece in Cat People is a series of collages by Melbourne artist Lucy James. She's produced these really colourful, really beautifully designed pieces that are not like any kind of artwork you see of cats at the moment. It really is the opposite of this kind of internet laser kitty kind of aesthetic. And when we were in Japan, a lot of the Japanese fans of Cat People were just blown away by Lucy's work, and it's really exciting.
I would probably have to say Takashi Homma's photo essay, because it was really surprising to receive that. He's one of those people that always exceeds your expectations, and what he ended up giving us was just a really honest, creative look into his life and his friends' lives. And I love that it looks like his photography. It looks like Japanese photography, and it kind of is exactly what the magazine needed. And that's probably, yeah, my favorite piece in the magazine.
When you describe, I guess, to friends or to random people, do people think you're a bit mad, or how do people react to that as an abstract concept who haven't actually seen what it looks like?
Yeah, we get a lot of blank looks from friends and family that kind of assume that it's something very trivial or simple, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but I think we then have to stress that we've made something that is somewhere between a typical magazine and an art book. And really our ambition for this was to make something that could sit alongside a lot of the art books that we buy and read. And so it's a serious endeavor that happens to include cats, but is really a way of looking at the lives and artistic practices of the people who own them.
Well, that was Loretta Florence in Melbourne speaking to Gavin Green and Jessica Lowe about their new cat magazine, Cat People. And he managed to get in the word there, catalyst. He was very clever. we'll start with you, Mark. When people come knocking at your door, and I understand they're publishing 1,000 copies and they're going to do it once a year, so it's not exactly going to be hitting newsstands every month, but there must be so many people who want to sell their magazines via Magma. When somebody comes with a title like this, are you kind of open arms, or is there quite a strict kind of procedure for people doing niche publishing to kind of get through before they can find a way onto your shelves?
There's a huge amount of people doing that kind of thing out there, and we've always struggled to cope with it. We've invented endless systems and gave the responsibility to an endless number of individuals, and it's never worked. But we try to receive them with open arms, and we try to look at every magazine like this and think about it very hard, try to read a little bit of it, see if actually, you know, it's proper English or whatever the language they're publishing it at. With Cat People, it's quite interesting because he just said it's almost like an art book. And in a way, you have a whole trend of magazines being like art books, because the book markets become so mainstream and so commercial, and every book needs to have a reason for being in a very precise market. And that's kind of opened up that area for magazines that can be a lot more open and have an idea like just, you know, Cat People. And one of the magazines that I brought here is a bit similar as well. It's more like an art book than a magazine, really. But it's got a very open brief, which you don't get in books anymore.
Ted, are there any furry feline friends walking around your home?
Yeah, you touched on a sore point. Yes, okay. One until recently.
I'm sorry about the recently part of that. Would you be a potential purchaser of Cat People?
I don't know that I'm a potential purchaser of Cat People. My first reaction was that it's so personal and specific as to be discomforting, but and now I admire it, I think, for a lot of the reasons that Mark does, which is I think that book publishing has become very safe, and when you look at newsstands, or at least the right newsstands, there is a kind of golden age of print, and I think it's fantastic and admirable that people are pursuing their passions in such fantastically creative ways.
Well, brilliant. We're going to hear more from both of these gentlemen in a moment. This is The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck, and my guests today are Mark Valley and Ted Moncrief.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
This is The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. And it's time again to turn to this week's guests. And this week I'm joined by Mark Valley, a Brazilian who came to Britain via Switzerland and who runs Magma, a great string of high-end bookstores here in the UK, specialising in art, graphics and design periodicals. He also runs Elephant magazine. And I'm also joined by Ted Moncrief, who runs Bloomberg Pursuits magazine, but has an extensive career that's included Condé Nast Traveller and also Newsweek. Gentlemen, it's time for you to pick your second title. Mark, what would you like to choose?
So it's a magazine you can't tell from the cover what it's called, which I always think commercially is a mistake, by the way.
Yeah, I think you should probably tell people what your magazine's called.
It's called Finn. And Finn apparently in Norway means nice. And it also means in French, the end. And so at the end, you can actually read the name
back
of the
cover,
magazine.
They've got the title.
On the back cover.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the first issue of this magazine. It's sponsored by the Arts Council of Norway. There's not a single ad in it. And it functions really a lot more like a book than a magazine. It's a book with a very open brief. I think the only focus it has is the city itself, Oslo, everybody seems to actually be based in Oslo, but I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
But the feeling you get reading through it is that you've read about a writer, you've looked through some really nice artwork, this nice fashion stories. You have the impression that you spent a nice 2 or 3 days in Oslo and you've met nice people.
And it's interesting, you sometimes wonder, and I'm not saying that they are, but you sometimes wonder what the ambition of these magazines are, because Norway has, from the government down, has an ambition to make Norway into a design country. They're doing everything they can to kind of brand the country as a design city for Oslo and the whole nation. So you wonder if some of that money that, as you say, comes from a state body. You see something pop up almost as an independent magazine, but there is, it's part of a bigger ambition about branding the nation. It's a small trim magazine, and they have, as you say, it almost looks like Roman numerals, where they've kind of stripped away parts of the letters just to leave kind of like three striking white character marks across the front cover. And then for you, Ted, what's going to be your second? Staying loyal to your brand.
Yes, my second is Bloomberg Businessweek, which isn't just a bit of naked corporate pandering, although it is that too. It's also just because I consistently admire their covers. Having worked at Newsweek, the Newsweekly game, especially on the newsstand, is to break through on a weekly basis. That can be a formidable and terrifying task, and I think they do it with. Often humor. They once did a corporate airline merger by depicting two planes copulating in the clouds with the headline, "Let's get it on." And I just admire their creativity.
We've had both the art director and some of the team from Bloomberg Businessweek on before. Does it make your job a bit more complicated in a way, though? Because when you're at parties and you say you work for the magazine division of Bloomberg, they're like, "Oh, I love that magazine. They always do crazy covers." Is there a bit of competition within Bloomberg because of that?
No, only because what we do is so incredibly different. They're a Newsweekly, we're a luxury lifestyle quarterly. What they do, and for which I am profoundly grateful, is our first cover was a photograph of an alligator eating an alligator wallet. With the headline "Where Luxury Begins and Ends," and that cover would not have been possible, I believe, within the organization if it hadn't been for Bloomberg Businessweek and all the bomb throwing that they had done before I got there.
And tell me, where do you sit in your job? You're here in London?
No, I'm in New York.
You just happen to be passing through London today, and we've seized you then.
Yes.
And so tell me, are you sitting in the same building as the Businessweek people, or do you bump into each other in the corridors of a morning?
Yes, if you've ever been to the building, there aren't really corridors.
Okay.
You'll have to visit sometime to see what I mean.
In the very fish tanky headquarters here in London.
Yeah, it's that times 10.
Okay.
But yeah, I sit on the floor above them.
Okay, so there is a kind of there's a whole kind of little hub of you that's appreciative of print and magazine publishing and that do you share resources? Do you share anything between you?
We do share some resources, but they're really the company's resources. They have about 2,500 reporters in 72 countries, and we can tap them depending on their availability. To work for us, and that's a huge pool of talent that I think we both draw upon.
Mark, returning to you, I know that you've got another title there. Let's have a quick look at one more of your titles.
Okay, I brought this issue of Art Review. Not necessarily my favorite magazine, but sometimes you open a magazine and you think, damn, I should have done that story, and you feel so jealous. And in this case, it's actually two or three articles on copyright laws, and which is... a really interesting and very tricky subject at the moment in art, with so many artists working with appropriation, but in the whole of visual culture. I mean, not a day goes by without you thinking, that person's just completely ripped off that person, and the legal position in all of this is just tricky. And for example, I work with a book publisher, and not a meeting goes by without us saying, okay, we must ask the lawyer if we can quote that, if we can mention that. It's such a tricky area at the moment.
There's a few publishers around the world that I think I'd quite like if they'd asked our permission whether they could use certain things that appear in Monocle.
Yes, and I've actually seen them. I've actually been interviewed by a French magazine, which, by the way, is a good magazine, but that's completely copied your concept from beginning to end.
So. Yes, I think I know exactly.
Exactly, it's quite shocking.
But you see... it's funny that you know, appropriation in art is a different thing, but certainly when you look at publishing, I'm amazed at how many art directors there are, and let's not dwell on the example too close to home for comfort, to be honest, but that how many art directors are happy not to have any ideas, in a way, just to actually look at other magazines. You see so many things that derive from one or two sources. You know, for both of you, you're seeing stuff on the shelves. Are you sometimes disheartened that so many things seem to be copying each other?
I must say, I don't think one should condemn that. I think creativity comes out of copying people and changing slightly things and doing things slightly different. I do think it would be a great shame if everyone started suing everybody for their ideas. I think one should promote originality in the positions we're in. Every time you see a new idea, one should recognize it and praise it. But to say, oh, that person's copied that person, less, you know, sue them, I don't think that's... I mean, art's always been about influence.
And Ted, for you, you know, do you sit down in with a big pile of magazines? You know, we do it here. We're certainly aware of what everybody else is doing. But often, in a way, to make sure that we don't do the same, we often think, okay, if that's their territory, we don't want that. We want to find a space on the newsstand where we're delivering content that you don't find everywhere else, because if it's everywhere else, then you know, why buy our magazine? But for you, how much interest do you take in the competition?
The same. I find the hegemony a bit depressing. There are these trends that you see very quickly. All the magazines start to look very much alike. Their missions aren't often alike. And I think that's the big question, which is, what's your mission? Who are your readers? And the design should flow from that. The idea that you would use a Martha Stewart typeface in a Newsweek context feels like children playing with a crayon box, not like professionals tailoring what is a very powerful visual medium for their specific audience.
And the other weird thing I find about the copying is, I understand you say you take things, design influences and change them, but how much meaning is often attached to good design? So I know, for example, here at Monocle, we've got to the point where we are through 7 years of conversations and experiences and debates and arguing things and coming to a belief about everything from, you know, how you run a city to how you make a good product to how you build a home that you want to live in. So sometimes when you see other magazines around the world trying to imitate Monocle or imitate, you know, Elephant or imitate everyone else, yeah, they kind of get the look, but the kind of meaning sometimes is just not there behind that design. And that's the bit that concerns me, I think.
But I think people do get an idea of something seminal. For example, I was at a meeting the other day and people told me, I mean, this sounds like praise, which it is actually. Somebody told me, oh, this is a hotel for Monocle type readers. That's what we want to achieve. And I think by doing that, you've actually created a style that everybody recognizes and that is seminal. And 100 people can copy. And the more people copy it, the more it will reinforce your brand and your look, because people will come back to that. And so I don't think, I think copying is part of art. And I think more people try to do Picasso, the more it reinforces Picasso. I mean, how many people have tried to do Picasso? I mean, it's just endless.
I wanted to ask you a very different question about art review. So it's interesting, these titles. In a way, they're very split personalities. Yes, they're talking about, you know, cutting edge artists, these people rising up with new talent. But they're also talking about what billionaires have on their walls.
Power.
It
actually has the word power on the cover.
Well, power eats the soul is the cover line. Yeah, it's quite interesting for you because you're in a way you're kind of alternative and on the edge, but in a way the books you're selling and the people you're representing, you know, some of those artists, you know, they're kind of corporate people in a way now as well.
Yes, I think that's the other part of that article about the interview was a lawyer whose biggest part of his practice is to manage estates from artists. And it looks like what in the 70s, say the money that musicians were making in the 70s is now being made by artists. And he was saying typically, a successful artist these days would have a house in New York, a house in Europe, a studio in New York, about 2 or 3 million in investments. And and about 10 or 20 million at his studio of work to be sold. I mean, wow, this is serious money. And it looks
Ted's
like...
Ted's nodding there. He says, that's my reader.
Exactly. Maybe they have Bloomberg on their shelves as well.
Actually, Ted, you've kind of gone the other way. You've kind of gone away from the corporate field for your next picks a little bit. You've chosen Man. And tell us about this.
Man About Town, which, again, I actually don't... It looks independent. It may be less independent than it appears to be. It's quite fat. It's matte. There's a wide variety of paper stocks inside. Mostly I admire it for its profiles. And I wouldn't even say the writing. It's just they introduce you to people that you may not have heard of. There are certainly familiar faces in there. But it delivers on its promise, which is it's largely focused on urban people, creative people.
Can I ask you a consumer question? When you read a magazine like Man About Town, does it make you want to do the things in its pages? Do you find good service journalism kind of gets you off your backside and thinks, I want that holiday, I want that shirt?
It depends how it's done. I mean, I'm often visually inspired by magazines, but I find the ideas, the writing, are not often what I would hope them to be. I think people write in a promotional way. It's become reflexive, and I would rather have the facts than feel like I'm being sold to. I don't personally like being sold to. I'd like to be informed, and then the decision is left up to me.
And when you do your magazine, is there an air of not criticism in a we don't like things kind of way, but do you try and make sure that your writers, bring some judgment to bear on what's good and bad in the market?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's always, there's a little vinegar with the oil is always a good thing. I think it just helps with credibility. And when I read that something was absolutely fantastic from beginning to end, I, in the end, don't believe any of it.
You and me alike. Mark, what's next?
It's a Prague-based magazine called Photograph. And the reason I brought this is that I feel, I mean, this may just be a personal feeling, but that there is a sort of a disappearance of great photography from the printed world in magazines. That this used to be the reason why most people started to love magazines. They love this big picture spreads, etc. And that photographers are being paid very poorly, and that the really good photographers, in order to make a living, are trying to veer towards other things such as advertising or, in this case, art. And the art world's become very, a very welcoming place for photographers. But it comes with some requirements. Just taking photographs is not good enough anymore. You need to come with a whole conceptual structure behind, and you need to make pretty obscure work, which is a very mixed blessing, I find. And this is one of the rare photography magazines left around. I think most of them had to shut down. And it's incredibly conceptual. And I somehow find this a little bit sad as a reader. I mean, I'm sort of missing big photography and big landscapes. And this is not that. This is exactly the opposite. It represents this new trend of photography, which in Elephant we call post-photography, which is a mixture of conceptual art with photography. And it includes a lot of people working with found photographies, photographs, with, say, cutting photographs up. I mean, doing just about anything with photographs, except what we used to know as photography.
What do you think about that, Ted? This idea of the disappearance almost of the classic photographer. I think there's some other pressures on it. One is that some magazines seem to believe that literally everybody is a photographer now because of the spread of digital photography and our cameras. And yeah, in short, if you've got Instagram and you filter everything, you can take some pretty cute pictures. But it seems to have spread across the pages of our magazines now, this belief that anybody can be sent off with a camera and come back with pictures.
I agree. And I think the thing that I'm constantly surprised and delighted by, and something that we really definitely try to mine at Pursuits, is there are astonishing photographers out there, and you don't need to go to the same names again and again. Finding them is not always easy, but I think there is a kind of golden age of photography going on. I just think the competing pressure is that there are just so many more images than there used to be. It's just proliferating like kudzu. And I agree, I think, between post-production techniques, which have thanks to Apple and other computer companies, have been put in the hands of virtually everyone. Everyone is a photographer, for good or for ill.
Just tell me, when you look at, you know, do photographers still come in with their portfolios? Is that still something that happens at your magazine? Are you still looking for talent like that? Or is, you know, is there such a kind of small group of people that you work with that you're not really looking for fresh names?
No, we're constantly looking for fresh names. I mean, I think part of being a young brand is giving opportunities to names that you haven't heard. We work with plenty of big names, but we go to galleries, we work contacts, we really dig to find people. The good news is that when you see great work, it jumps off the screen or jumps off the page. And we recognize it almost immediately, and we give those people big assignments right out of the gate. And so far, it's worked wonderfully well for us.
And just two tangentials, do you keep an eye on the art market? You know, for both, we're talking here about, you know, how much inspirational work is coming up through the art market. Is that something you're both desperate to write about and potentially take some of those great photographers as well back into the world of editorial?
Yes. I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical of the art market just because the impulse to commodify is so instantaneous these days. And I think the pressures on the photographers and the artists are tremendous because of the amount of money that's at stake. I mean, we try to find people who that isn't their driving passion.
And Mark, you know, that photography element that you're talking about, you know, I wonder if there is also the problem is that, you know, the world is so visual now in a way that it's never been before. Every time we're sent a text from our friends, it's attached to a picture. We're bombarded with so much imagery that for cut through, you either have to go kind of like, as you say, crazy, conceptual, you need to be kind of way out there, or you have to come back to this, which would probably be my kind of preference, you come back to something a little bit more old school, and you still do see some people going back to, you know, I don't know, Polaroid or to black and white print and things. Are those the two areas where you can still have some kind of potential to kind of make a mark?
Well, I think that's definitely part of the problem. However, I think a belief in photography still works. I think photography as a language can still talk. And I had a perfect example of that when, about a month ago in Switzerland, the son of my girlfriend said, oh, let's go and see this exhibition by Sebastian Salgado. And I was like, oh, no, not another Sebastian Salgado exhibition. But because it was the first time he asked me to go and see an exhibition, we went to see it. And I just stood in front of those pictures in awe. In complete awe, thinking this is just astonishing, amazing, this is great art, forget the conceptual stuff, this is photography. And so I think photography still has a language. It's like, well, we have words everywhere, we all speak in sentences, but when you read good writing, you can still tell it's good writing and you don't need obtuse concepts to make it good writing, it just is.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I'd like to thank both of my guests today. Mark Valley is the publisher of Elephant Magazine and runs Magma. And Ted Moncrief is the man behind Bloomberg Pursuits Magazine and has an illustrious career as well, which you've heard about at the top of the show. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for joining me today. Well, that brings us to the end of edition 63 of The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck. Special thanks to my guests today, Mark Valley and Ted Moncrief. Our producers were David Pleasant and Tom Edwards. And behind the glass here at Midori House was studio manager Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. But for now, until next time, it's goodbye. Have a great weekend.